Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it cost to dress like an American? And what does our love affair with trendy looks at bargain basement prices cost the world's garment workers and the environment we all share? The average American now adds 64 items of clothing a year to the supply in our bulging closets and dresser drawers. And if you wonder how that's possible in a sluggish economy, it's because we are paying stunningly low prices for all those poly-blend shirts and faux leather shoes, knowing that few of them will last us more than a single season. And as my guest today learned in taking a critical look at her own shopping habits, all that impulse buying still fails to keep us from fretting we have nothing to wear. Elizabeth L. Klein is a journalist and blogger. Her new book is called Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. Elizabeth, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So you admit that you were as guilty as all the rest of us when you started this investigation. Talk about what got you thinking about the cheap clothing phenomenon and what it all really meant.
Well, I mean, as you mentioned, I'm guilty of everything that I describe in the book, and I just got to a point where I noticed that I really didn't want to buy anything that cost more than 20 or 30 bucks. I was just so stubbornly cheap, and I had a closet full of clothes. I owned more than 350 pieces of clothing, and then I realized that my shopping habits were actually made me kind of the typical American consumer. Like you mentioned, we are buying more than 60 garments a year per now. And I really wanted to know what was going on in the fashion industry that got us to this place where we were stockpiling cheap clothes and treating clothes as if they were disposable.
Mm-hmm. You're a lot younger than I am, but when I was in college in the late 80s, early 90s, we would occasionally buy something at Target, but we would never admit it. You know, you would just say you got it out of town or somewhere else. And then a decade later, everybody was doing it. And if you'll pardon the pun, Target shoppers could be out of the closet.
Yeah, I mean, our first lady, we love it when she wears that Target dress. She has like a $34.99 Marona dress that mm-hmm. she's been seen in a couple times, and she's always in the news for wearing cheap fashion, and cheap fashion has certainly gone a very dramatic image overhaul in the last, I would really say, 10 years. It's gone from being stigmatized to now where we have bragging rights about it, you know? It's become this almost American way to shop.
Yeah, there was that Sharon Stone showing up for the Oscars in a Target t-shirt. A Gap t-shirt, right?
Yeah, in the Gap. Right, yeah. That was really a watershed moment in terms of sort of corporate chain store fashion becoming acceptable. And that shirt, I can't think how much it costs off the top of my head, but it probably would seem expensive to those of us who now shop at Target and places like that.
Hmm. It's really astonishing to read about how the places that supply our clothing have changed over the past just two decades. Talk about the decline of the American garment industry just since 1990.
Sure. So the garment and textile trades have been two of the fastest dying industries of the last 10 years, and the change has been really dramatic. We now only make 2% of our clothing and 1% of our footwear in the United States, mm-hmm. and we made about half of it here in 1990. So that shift has been really, really dramatic, and I live in New York, and I write in the book about what's happened to the garment center and what's happened to those workers that used to have those jobs here.
And these are people who had earned a solid middle-class living before, and now these are jobs that overseas pay sometimes less than a dollar a day.
Well, I would say you'd have to go back to the 1950s and 60s to a time when the U.S. garment industry was still very unionized, and it was a way to really work your way into the middle class, and it was a very very integral part of the American dream and being able to move your way up. And then, along came all these trade liberalizations, things like NAFTA, and you saw this downward pressure on garment worker wages, and everything did move overseas, And now garment work is almost universally a very low-paying job. And, you know, in the book, I don't really talk about sweatshops. I talk about legally run factories and how it's perfectly legal to pay poverty wages in most of the developing country. Bangladesh, for example, their minimum wages per month is it's $43 a month for garment workers.
Hmm. And, you know, anybody who's ever tried to sew anything realizes that even the simplest garment is difficult to put together.
I know, right? We forget that this really is a skill and that clothing is essentially, it's handmade. No matter where in the world it's put together, there's a person behind that sewing machine. And it's certainly a craft that we used to respect and understand. And I think that when we outsourced our garment industry, one of the sort of unintended consequences is that we really became disconnected from what we were wearing because knowledge and information about clothing stopped being passed down from generation to generation.
You know, my grandmother's father was a tailor, and she didn't sew herself, but she absolutely knew a quality garment when she picked it up, and she would look at the seams and look at the cut. And when you say understand how clothing is made, that's something that a lot of us have lost. We're not sure what's good and what's bad.
Yeah, and I think it plays into all these issues that we're discussing here, where if you're a consumer and you don't know a lot about what is a good fabric and what's not, or if you don't know anything about garment construction, you're going to be more privy to accepting that $10 dress. You know, I think that it's all part of the same. It's all part of the same issues, and I certainly, when I was shopping cheap, I don't think I ever once looked at a fabric label, and I didn't do that until I started writing the book and I realized that probably 70% of my clothing was synthetic and a majority of it was polyester.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because when you say don't look at labels, we've gotten so good and so cautious about looking at the origins of the things we eat and a lot of the other products
right.
we use, and somehow clothing just kind of passes by the wayside.
I know it's a interesting paradox. I think that, you know, going back to the polyester thing, I see consumers who are so conscious of their plastic consumption, you know, like people who never want to buy, don't want to buy a lot of disposable plastic bottles. They don't take the plastic bag at the grocery store, but yet they're perfectly comfortable having a closet full of polyester, which is, you know, it's made from a non-renewable resource, oil, and it's not biodegradable. So there are a lot of parallels there. With clothes right now, we really look at one thing, and that's the price, and hope that it's cheap, and don't really look at much else.
I hate to ask this question, but I think it's relevant here. Are women the worst offenders here?
yeah. Women have always been largest clothing consumers, but that said, the fast fashion chains are certainly trying to rope men into these buying practices as well, but their clothes are just less fashion sensitive than women's are. So it's always going to be more something that female consumers do, but it's also up to us to find alternatives and to make the fashion industry more accountable.
Let's talk a little bit about the marketing of these cheap clothes, because one thing that they've been really successful at is making it appear as if clothing is almost perishable. Like if you don't get it now, it won't be worth having. And if you don't get it now, it might be gone tomorrow.
Right. That's a really interesting point. I don't talk about it too much in the book, but I do talk about how, you know, we've been trained now to know that if you walk into a store that is constantly putting out new stock, that you really don't have time to think about that purchase and come back for it because it's probably going to be gone.
Mm-hmm.
Clothes are moving out of stores really quickly now. And, I mean, stores like Zara and H&M, the real leaders of fast fashion, they don't have a lot of sales because their consumers buy everything that's put out on the floor.
Yeah.
And the problem with that is that it doesn't give consumers who do want to shop differently a lot of space. You know, it makes you impulsive, whereas 20 years ago, when clothes were put out seasonally and they cost more money, you would go home and think about it. You know, if something cost $150 and you knew you could wait for it to go on sale, you might go home instead of buying something and then being like, wait, why did I buy this? And then it sits in your closet.
Yeah, you're right about going, I think it was Forever 21, and buying like a black hoodie.
Yeah.
And then feeling like you just had to have it that day.
Right. And the irony, of course, is that I already owned four. You know, I own several other black hoodies, and I just really remember feeling like there was also that feeling of the hunt, which is something that I think consumers get lured into. I couldn't find the full stock on the floor anywhere, and I was sent all over the store, and by the time I found it, I wanted that reward. I wanted to take it home with me.
Mm-hmm. And then there's the issue for some people will purchase clothing and it didn't cost very much. And so even if it doesn't work out, they don't bother taking it back.
Yeah. I mean, that really just gets at the psychology of cheap. When things don't cost a lot of money, we just simply don't put a lot of thought into how we're buying it, what happens after we buy it. It also extends into maintenance. If you buy something that's really cheap, and the button, you know, maybe it starts falling off or you spill something on it, consumers are a lot less likely to actually take the time out to have that garment repaired. And it just adds to this disposable relationship that we have to clothing.
So nobody wants to look like they're wearing a bunch of cheap garbage. Talk a little bit about what manufacturers and designers do in order to cut corners and have clothing look, at least on the hanger when you're in the store, the way it needs to look, but not cost extra.
Sure. I mean, a lot of it has to do with the materials, which I think is something that these retailers might be honest about. But, you know, it's like, I think that there was like a men's suit designer who I interview in the book, and he was talking about how, you know, the process of making wool suits, how that's changed over time. You know, consumers have gotten so cheap that he knows, for example, that he has to make a men's suit for $300. Well, how do you make a fully formed suit for $300? Well, first you make it out of polyester and viscose. You put a lot of synthetic material into it, which for some consumers might be okay, but the reality is if you wear a suit like that on a hot day and it's made out of materials that don't breathe, you're going to feel it.
A bad choice in Dallas, Texas, I can tell you that.
Yeah. And fabric's also gotten thinner and lower grade, and that extends even to natural fibers, like cashmere and silk. There are ways to process it where it's just simply not as well made. And then it extends into details on clothes. You know, I went to factories in China, and I write about this in the book, and they're like, you know, what you should do if you want to make that garment cheaper is take all the pleats out or take some of the buttons off. And they really want you to diminish the detail and the craftsmanship of the garment and just leave the essence, you know, leave the things that to the untrained eye are going to be acceptable.
Journalist and blogger Elizabeth L. Klein is my guest. Her new book is called Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. We'd love to hear your experiences with this or your questions at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Elizabeth L. Klein. She's a journalist, blogger, and author of the new book, Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. Join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Elizabeth, I want to get back to this question of labor costs because it turns out you've discovered that a lot of manufacturers could give their workers a significant raise without consumers on the purchasing end really being affected all that much.
Yeah, that specifically is true of these larger chains that I'm talking about, because they're operating in countries where the labor costs are so low that oftentimes the retail price, I think labor is something like less than 1% of the price that you're paying for the clothes, and it changes per company, but it's very, very low. And also, what it would take to increase these people's wages to a quote-unquote living wage, or just something where it's not just a poverty wage, people are able to save up and send their kids to school and buy proper homes, the pay increase would not be that dramatic. So I think that's something that I really push for in the book, and hopefully that we'll see retailers doing, because right now they're really doing whatever they can get away with, the least, kind of the least they can, and that extends to the wages they're paying. A lot of, I would say that most of them are trying to operate within the confines of the law, but the law is that you can pay people poverty wages in the developing countries where they're producing clothes.
Can we assume if we can afford to and choose to buy sort of upscale clothing with designer labels that we are getting good quality stuff and that the workers on the other end are being fairly treated?
Well, those are two separate issues. There's the quality issue and then there's the labor issue. Mm-hmm. If you see that someone is operating in China and it's a luxury brand and you see that H&M or Target is operating in China, you can assume that the factory conditions, whatever they may be, are going to be pretty similar, unless the brand in question is someone who's really come out and said, here are all of our factories, here's, we've decided to pay them a living wage. If not, then you can assume that a factory is a factory is a factory. I think some brands have a little bit better monitoring system in place to make sure that there aren't legal abuses happening, but again, it's legal to pay poverty wages in China and in Bangladesh. Now, in terms of quality, there are higher-end brands that do make a good product, and it's not necessarily always overpriced, but it's up to consumers to be educated about what they're buying to make sure that they're not getting ripped off. I would say you can't buy something that's quality for $20, but do you have to pay $1,000 for quality? No, no. The point is you have to, consumers really need to reconnect and look at the labels, look at what they're buying.
Tell us about your experience at the Alta Gracia factory in the Dominican Republic.
Sure. Alta Gracia is a sort of a model factory and just a really inspiring place to be. It's a unionized factory in the Dominican Republic. That's where they also earn a living wage. And I, you know, met people who were able to take their wages and build homes and pay for their kids to go to school. And before, you know, it'd be an extended family living in essentially a shack. So it can really, living wage structures can really dramatically improve garment workers' lives. And the other cool thing about Alta Gracia is that it's actually owned by Knights Apparel, and they're the largest maker of collegiate clothing in the United States. So it was really their initiative to say, we're going to own this factory, we're going to take full responsibility for what's happening there, And I just think they're doing a really great job.
And by providing better for their workers, they actually get better quality work out of them. Is that right?
I think that there's definitely a connection there. The rapport in that factory was just fantastic. I mean, just, you know, you could tell that there were really good friendships between managers and workers, and just it was just a good working environment. And you don't necessarily see that a lot of times in the garment industry anymore, because it's so competitive and it's so focused on the bottom line. So it was just nice to go into a factory and be like, this is civilized. This is somewhere that you can come into work and feel good about what you do and feel like your boss respects you.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Robert in Dallas. Hi, Robert.
Oh, hi. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you.
Hi, Robert.
Hello. I had a question for you. I actually, for the last 18 years, I worked for a large company called Tom James that makes 80% of our clothing in America.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very, very proud of that fact, as a lot of my competitors have made, you know, found ways to cut corners by making things in China and overseas. We still stubbornly stay with the, you know, made in America. And I think that resonates with my clients. Do you find that other people would be willing to spend a little bit more to get the Made in America label?
I think that what we saw, first of all, that's fantastic that your company produces 80% in the U.S. But I think what we've seen is we went through maybe a period of 2 decades where that wasn't really something that was important to consumers, buying things that were American-made. And I just see people doing a complete 180 on the issue now, and I think a lot of that is tied to the recession. And I think that that was just a real wake-up call for a lot of people, waking up and realizing that we don't have a middle class anymore, and that is really connected to manufacturing. And I see more brands moving their production back to the States, but more importantly, I see more consumers who are really invested in supporting American-made products. And yes, they're not willing to pay a premium for it, but they're certainly willing to pay more to support jobs here.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Leslie in Denton. Hi, Leslie.
Hi. Thanks so much. This is a great topic and really important facets in many layers. I've got 2 teenage boys, and our family just moved this past week from our 2,800 square foot house of 12 years to 1,100 square feet in an apartment in a dorm on the University of North Texas campus. So
that's a lot of editing required in one's wardrobe.
We had a lot of editing, seriously. So this information is really good for me in that sense. We thought we had closets, my husband and I, that were well organized, and I edit, and the joke around our house is don't stand still too long or mom will sell you in a garage sale. But trying to explain to our 13-year-old son why it isn't okay with me, regardless of the cost or the low cost of his clothes, that he changes wanting to wear one jean style to another based on, you know, 2 or 3 inches of width in the legs.
Yeah.
From month to month. It's not about the money. It's about people's lives. So do you think that this book, I mean, they're both readers, both our guys are. It seems like this would be relevant for teens who are interested in recycling and using properly and not wasting just because it's not the moral and right thing to do.
What do you think, Elizabeth? Did you have teens in mind when you were writing?
I think that I certainly address everything that you're talking about in the book. And you know, I think that the generation that you're talking about, they are conscious. I mean, they care about environmental issues. It's just no one's really made these connections yet. No one's extended the conversation to clothing, which is why I really wanted to write about it, because I think people, they care about the environment. They certainly care about the American economy. And if they can tie all these things together in their mind and keep them with them when they go out to buy clothes, I think it really does change. It will change the way people shop. And you know, I think that young people, we all want to look good, you know, and this book is not an affront to that. Everyone wants to be stylish. They want to, you know, to fit in and to look good. It's really that excess consumption that you're talking about and that I'm talking about that we need to rein in. It's how much and to what extent we've taken this habit.
Let's talk about that excess consumption. I think for a lot of us, we feel as if as long as we're taking the clothes that we're no longer wearing and donating them somewhere, Goodwill or elsewhere, we're sort of off the hook. And I would love it if you'd talk about the chapter that you titled The Afterlife of Cheap Clothes.
Well, the problem with that is I think people have forgotten that clothes have to be made. You know, it's like there are resources involved in actually producing them. So no matter what happens to them after you use them, the reality is that a tremendous amount of energy and natural resources went into creating them. And that can't be undone. You know, and world fiber usage was at 10 million tons in 1950, which is a lot. And now it's at 82 million tons. Mm. And it's growing every year. Just you know how we were talking about externalizing the environmental problems of the fashion industry. You know, China's got a lot of our textile mills now, and China doesn't have a lot of environmental regulations. Well, we don't have to deal with that, and we don't have to pay for it in the price of our clothes. It's kind of the same thing with clothing waste. A lot of our clothing is shipped overseas to Africa, so we don't have to deal. We don't have to deal with a lot of the bigger picture issues of that either. We don't have to see it. We donate it, and it just disappears.
Hmm.
So we don't have to think about it.
And for clothing that is no longer wearable, if it's been a blended fiber, it's hard to even recycle it. Is that right?
Yeah, I really hope that changes, because there is, right as it stands now, I'm pretty sure it's impossible to separate it. Yeah, it is, and to separate most fabric blends.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of our clothing is made out of that now. So in terms of getting to a place where we can fully recycle the textiles we're producing, that has to be addressed in some way. And then the other thing is that, you know, people are still tossing so much clothes, 68 pounds of textiles a year, and if There's so much, you know, toxic dyes in clothes and shoes, especially like the glues and toxins that are used to process leather. If that's sitting in a landfill, that's a problem.
Talk about those dyes and about fabric production and leather production, because there are places in the world, not in this country, but where literally rivers will run a rainbow of different colors depending on the day of the week and what's being done.
Yeah, I write in the book about my travels to Bangladesh, which is just this like beautiful, beautiful, amazing country, and I drove out to the countryside to visit some textile mills, and the runoff, and it wasn't just textile mills, it was a number of different industries, but I mean, you could just see the dyes and the effluents, the toxins from the factories were just going straight into ditches by the road, so there was no proper disposal, in terms of processing that waste. And it's just really unfortunate, because, again, that's part of why the products coming out of those countries are so cheap, is because there aren't a lot of regulations. And that, I mean, it's something that we're going to have to deal with, because these countries are signing up for some really major environmental crises, and China is already seeing the fallout from that.
I want to talk about the development in our sort of insatiable desire for new things all the time. You quote a statistic that at the start of the Depression, the average woman had, was it 6 or 9 outfits, and the average man had 3 or 6, something like
right.
that. Right. And these days, it's dozens of outfits per person.
I know. It is such a huge shift, and I think that It ties together so many different issues and so many different ways that our society has changed. But a lot of times we're buying the deal. We walk into a store and we're just, we can't walk out without, you know, picking something up because it's so cheap. And then we get it home and it doesn't really add a lot to our lives. It sits around. We don't get a lot of use out of it. And I think that it really just has to do with the psychology of things that are low priced. They're irresistible in a certain way. It's kind of impossible to pass them up. And I think a lot of people are just buying things because they can and aren't necessarily happy about that or fulfilled by it. It just kind of is it's just the way things are right now.
Is it reasonable to place some blame on the way the fashion industry is covered in the media?
Sure, yeah. But I think that those, you know, it's kind of a chicken or egg thing where we've gotten to this place where these stores are capable of putting out new trends so quickly, and so they've also figured out that if they can, you know, get a celebrity wearing one of their looks, and that's great for the store, and then it works the other way around, that if a celebrity is wearing a high-end piece, that they can quickly knock it off in China and have it in the store, and that consumers will also want to go out and buy that as well. So, I mean, it really works both ways.
I had never heard of Zara before I read your book, and so I went on their website and looked, and I was kind of glancing through things, and a couple of the things had, you know, it would say People and have an exclamation point, and I couldn't figure out what that was, and then I realized, oh, this must have appeared in People magazine, and they're letting us know that this is brand new because of that.
Yeah, I haven't seen that actually, but that would make sense. The tabloid culture and celebrity culture and fast fashion are bedfellows. You know, they work together pretty seamlessly to keep people buying. And that's a whole other issue right there in terms of how obsessed we are with celebrities and what they're doing and wearing, and the fact that, you know, people do want to recreate a celebrity's outfit, you know, from head to toe. You know, they want to be able to go out and get the belt, the dress, the pants, the shoes, the whole look.
For $49.
Yeah, right, exactly. And a lot of these magazines do have those features now where it's like, okay, the celebrity paid $1,000 or $5,000 for their look, but you can get it for $50 or $100. And, I mean, that's another thing about that is that I really do think that the high-end fashion industry that's kind of cropped up is pushing people to be cheaper.
Elizabeth L. Klein is my guest. She's a journalist, blogger, and author of the new book Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. We'll take more of your calls at 1-800-933-5372 and more of your emails to think@kera.org after the break. We'll be back in about 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist, blogger, and author Elizabeth L. Klein. Her new book is called Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find John on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, John.
Oh, great to be on the program.
Welcome.
And a very interesting topic. The only comment I wanted to make is I've seen this the shift from this 50% of the garments, you know, made in 1990 made in the United States to like less than or 2% or so today. And, you know, I don't think anyone is winning in this low-cost labor scheme globalization. You know, I don't think it's good for the countries that manufacture the clothing. And from what I understand, a lot of, and your guest is so certainly more knowledgeable than me, but I understand a lot of the material is made in the United States and then shipped sometimes halfway across the world and then returned. You know, and I think sometimes the transportation might be as much as the actual labor in the garment in some, you know, some types of garments. It just doesn't make sense to me. I think that to get a little extra profit for these, the clothing manufacturers or the brand names, so to speak, I think we're sacrificing a lot. You know, I don't think anyone's winning. I think the people that are making this stuff are just barely getting by, and And I think the only winner might be, you know, the executives that run these companies.
Well, thanks very much for your call. Did you want to comment, Elizabeth?
No, I 100% agree with what he's saying.
We have an email here from Mark who writes, I don't have a clue about what I'm looking at when it comes to the quality of clothing. How can I practically become an educated consumer and understand the fabric and construction of the clothes I'm looking at?
Well, I think that, you know, he's headed in the right direction just in terms of even thinking about it. You know, there are, I think you should start by looking at the fabrication label on clothes, which is luckily still there. Still have to put that in there. So I think that, you know, you can't go wrong with at least trying to buy natural fibers, so cotton, wool, silk, cashmere, and linen. And even if you think you don't really know what you're looking for, still flip the garment inside out. I think that if you take a little bit more time to study the garment, look at the type of buttons that are used and how they're sewn on, and just the details, you know, if it looks like it was sewn together with a little bit more care, trust yourself to be able to notice the difference, because a lot of times it's just that people aren't even looking.
Mm-hmm.
And that if they would look, some of these differences actually would be apparent.
I really loved your story in the book where you write about not even knowing if this pair of boots that you had bought could be repaired. You didn't know that it was available, and they came back to you better than when they were new.
Yeah, that was an embarrassing moment for me. I called a cobbler and was like, "Have you ever resold a boot? Is that possible?" I had no idea. I mean, it's like the caller who called in about her teenage son. I grew up with this, you know. I grew up in the era of fast fashion, mm-hmm. And I had to, I really had to figure out how things used to be. And of course, yeah, I took my shoes in, and they resold them for me, put on a new heel, shined them, polished them, and they look better, literally better than they did when I got them from the store. And the sole was better than the one that I got, than the original sole. So they, it didn't wear out as quickly. And I actually just wore those boots the other night. I still have them.
So it is, and these people have been here all along, and there are also really good tailors and seamstresses and people who can make clothing fit differently rather than buying something brand new.
Yeah, I've just really gotten into that aspect of my transformation, just like going to a seamstress and making sure my clothes fit, or altering them in a certain way, having them altered if they're not quite right. Because a lot of times we buy things and it's like there's always just something a little bit off about them, whether it's the fit or maybe there's some embellishment that we're not really crazy about. But if you think of clothes more as sort of a canvas, you know, as fabric that is sewn together, and think of in terms of its potential and what it could look like, I think it's a lot of fun. I mean, I love taking my things to a tailor and making them work for me. I think it's really satisfying, and I think that something, you know, people used to do a lot more of, and hopefully it's something that people will, reconnect with in the future.
Another interesting aspect of all this is the idea that the vintage market mm-hmm. Is getting tighter and tighter, because if you're going back 20 or 25 years now, even then it was fast fashion.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's one thing that I write about in that chapter where I go to go behind the scenes at the Salvation Army, mm-hmm. Because what I found, and it to the textile recyclers, is because a lot of that chapter is about quality fade and how even in the secondhand market, they're struggling to make a living, because the stuff that we're donating now is, quite frankly, it's crap, and mm-hmm. the value of secondhand clothing has just really declined in recent years, and you do have to go back to really the 80s and before to find things that are better made in the racks of Goodwill. I mean, I live around the corner from Goodwill, and from a Goodwill location, I'm in there all the time. You have to dig. You really have to dig now to find anything that's worth owning.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Stephen on the line in Dallas. Hey, Stephen.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well, thank you.
I have a question for your guest, Ms. Klein, mm-hmm. if she's aware of the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations that are taking place as a trade agreement between Pacific Rim nations with the United States, driven by lobbyists, basically. And I'm sure it's going to have a negative effect on those countries.
Is this is it regulating the textile imports from those countries?
It's a trade agreement much like NAFTA, but it's like NAFTA on steroids, where it affects many different industries.
I talk in the book about the trade liberalizations that's happened, and I know some of those countries were part of earlier deals. I don't write about that one specifically, but I do talk about how unregulated the industry has become. I think maybe that's what you're getting at.
Do you spend less time shopping now than you did before? Or does it actually take more time to find things that you really want to live with for a matter of years as opposed to a matter of weeks?
You mean, personally, I spend, when I buy fewer things, but I spend more time shopping, a lot more time. I actually enjoy it a lot more because I feel like I know what I'm doing and I know what I want. And that goes back to what I was saying earlier in the conversation about intentionality and really being strategic when you shop, because usually I'm looking for something very specific, whereas before I didn't know, I just bought whatever the stores put out for me, whatever the latest trend was. So yeah, I think I spend more time on my clothes in general, but it's not just shopping. I mean, it could be time spent at the seamstress or time looking online to see what styles are out there and what I might want to buy. Because, I mean, if you decide to spend more money on clothes and to be, you know, so you can buy things that are well-made, you're not just going to walk out to a store and drop a lot of money on something. You want to know what you're doing before you leave the house.
Yeah. And so many of us have lots of clothes that we never wear and the same, I don't know, 5 to 10 outfits that we wear all the time.
I know, yeah. I talk about that in the book, about how I had like 34 tank tops. And I mean, just logic would tell you that you can't really make good use out of 34 of essentially the same garment. And I also talk in the book about how a lot of times with really trendy clothes, we're basically buying the same type of garment in the latest print or color.
Yeah.
So you get a very homogenous closet that doesn't have, it doesn't have true variety. And in a sense, we are all kind of walking around in uniforms and the same thing. I think that the American fashion landscape is really homogenous right now.
Yeah, it is interesting that you can look in your closet and think, I can't possibly wear that maroon cardigan. I have to have aubergine. And, you know, it suddenly seems like a big deal.
Uh-huh. I know, and I think that's really the whole color transition is really sped up over the last few years, where you do feel kind of out of step in last season's color.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Remember, you can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's speak to Stan in Grapevine. Hi, Stan.
Hi there. Just a question about this problem as being solely an American problem. Did the research cover any kind of a situation like this, say, in Europe or other westernized countries? Do they have the same kind of consumption mentality that we seem to have here in regards to these things?
Thanks for your call.
That's a great question. Well, a lot of the fast fashion chains that I talk about in the book are actually European imports. Like H&M is based in Sweden. And Zara is a Spanish company, and it was really pioneered, the whole fast fashion concept was pioneered in Europe. So it started there, and it spread to the U.S. I focus the book on what's happened in the U.S. specifically. I was mostly interested in that history, but there's actually a great book called To Die For by a U.K. journalist named Lucy Siegel, and she describes how the problem has unfolded overseas. So it's actually a conversation that people are having internationally now.
The one thing I'll tell you, your book has given me so much to think about my own family's habits. I will say shopping for kids, I'm not sure I'm ready to spend a great deal more because even when you do, the stuff gets pretty torn up in a single school year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of people have asked me that, and the book it's talking about excess consumption, conspicuous consumption. It's not about you know, if you need clothes, your kids need clothes, your kids grow out of clothes, like, of course, you're going to go out and buy them more clothes. The book is really talking about just this sort of out-of-control cycle of buying and tossing clothes is what I'm getting at. So I'm not going to fault you if your kids if you your kids outgrow what they wear and you have to go buy them something new.
Can you talk a little bit about handbags and other accessories and sort of the way they're priced and you know, put on sale and that sort of thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean I'm definitely not the leading expert on that issue, but what I know about it is that handbags and accessories, handbags and shoes, especially in the high end, have some of the highest markups of anything that you can buy. And I think that retailers have figured out that people will put a lot of money there because it's acceptable to wear the same handbag every day and same pair of shoes every day, unlike, say, a dress.
Yeah.
And people will they will drop thousands of dollars on a pocketbook. And I'm not sure if I think that most consumers in that sector anyway are a lot of times they're just buying the name, mm-hmm. And they really want it for status reasons and don't have a really good sense of whether or not it's worth their money.
So you're telling me a $5,000 purse does not hold my wallet and my lipstick any better than the purse I bought for $50?
That is what I'm saying.
How have your friends reacted to this project? I mean, has everyone sort of come to you with their guilty confessions, or have people said, well, we just won't go shopping with Elizabeth anymore?
I think that sometimes people are it's hard for people to initially to imagine the alternative. I think a lot of times people think, oh, well, then so you're saying that I'm supposed to go buy, a $1,000 Gucci dress instead. And that's really not what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. And that's why people who have actually read the book really love it, because it's talking about the whole life cycle of clothing and about knowing and understanding clothing and supporting rationally priced clothes. So clothes where the price tag reflects good labor practices, good environmental practices, and good quality, and something that's actually put together well and is stylish at the same time. I think people are a little fearful that I'm telling them to go out and spend a lot more money, but that's actually not what it's about.
It does seem if we all begin shopping more carefully and more selectively, that mega retailers will get the message and maybe change their suppliers.
Right. I mean, these transitions that I'm talking about are consumer driven. You know, people have just gotten so cheap, and retailers are twisting themselves in knots trying to figure out, okay, last year consumers wanted to pay $20 for a dress, and now they only want to pay $19. Well, what kind of a dress can you make for $19? Hmm. So in that sense, a lot of this is coming from consumers, and it really is up to us to demand an alternative.
Elizabeth L. Klein is a journalist and blogger. Her new book is called Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. Elizabeth, really interesting research here. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell will produce the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download that podcast every day at kera.org/think. Any comments, questions, or suggestions can be emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.